The Lord be with you. I don't know if you know this guy's name, Sean Parker. You probably know the other guy. Recognize the other guy? Mr. Zuckerberg. So Sean worked with him at the beginning of Facebook, however many years ago that was. Is that 10, 15 years ago? And more recently, he has been revealing what was going on at the beginning of that organization, that company, right at its conception. Mark Zuckerberg is now 35, only 35, just a few years younger than me, and he has a wealth of $80 billion. Sean has a bit less billions. He only has $2.5 billion and is trying to help cancer now rather than work for Facebook. But recently in an interview, he said this. The thought process behind building the Facebook was this. How can we consume as much of your time and conscious attention as possible? That means that we need to sort of give you a little dopamine hit every once in a while when someone likes or comments on a photo or post or whatever. It's a social validation feedback loop. It's exactly the kind of thing a hacker like myself would come up with because you're exploiting a vulnerability in human psychology. The inventors understood this consciously, and we did it anyway. Thank you very much. So I'm after your attention, this fragile thing that is increasingly hard to get. Each one of us, we have a limited amount of attention. We're asleep for 8.5, maybe a bit less, maybe a bit more hours. We're at work for maybe 9.5 hours. And then we have that little bit at the end of the day. We have 3 hours of stuff to do just to get through life, so that happens. And then you have this bit at the end, this leisure time thing, this space in your life. And increasingly, that little bit of attention space is being eaten up by a thing called technology. So I'm going to talk today about technology and simplifying technology in the light of being a disciple of Jesus Christ in our real world as we are here today in the world with computers and mobile phones and all the rest of it, trying to work out what it means to be a follower of Jesus for us. Is that okay? That's just as well because that's all I've got today. Oh, there he goes. I've just got to check my mobile phone. I think that's a message for me. It works like that, doesn't it? The notifications come and our minds are taken somewhere else. In contrast, Jesus says, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle or humble or meek in heart, and you will find rest for your souls, for my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So Jesus stands in front of us, maybe with the image that you started the service with, with that image of the heart, which is written on it saying, be careful. And he says, come to me, all you who are heavy, heavy, heavy laden. Take care of your heart. Your heart, there's a battle going on for your heart right now. Come to me and you may find rest. In contrast, the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy, but I have come that you might have life and have it to the full. There is a thief, I think Jesus would want to say to us in our culture particularly, wanting to take us away from our true selves, the made in the image of God selves that he made us for. A couple of books I'll mention today. This is a really good one by David Kinnaman and Mark Matlock. They work for Barna. Have you heard of Barna? They're a kind of Moros they do lots of asking people what they think questions. And they've done this study of Christians who are surviving, aged between 23 and 30, surviving in the world. How are they remaining resilient? They know the statistics of people turning away from church, leaving church, particularly within that age band. So they thought they would do a study and ask those who are sticking around, who are still resiliently following Jesus and loving Jesus. And they've come up with, they've noticed five things that they do differently to other people. But they described the environment that these people live in with this phrase, digital Babylon. That's really good. It conjures up the image of exile when the children of Israel were taken out of their comfort zone, their community, their place of security. Their identity was shifted and they were placed in Babylon under an oppressive ruler. But ours is a different kind of place. Maybe we feel like we're in exile, but we're in exile from this thing that is outside of us, this digital version of that. And they said it's an accelerated and complex culture that we live in. We are the first generation of humans who cannot rely on the earned wisdom of previous generations to help us live with these rapid technological changes. Describe our accelerated, complex culture that is marked by phenomenal access, profound alienation, and a crisis of authority. Digital Babylon. I've been thinking about this for the last few weeks and then thinking and researching, and I came across a marketing company, not a significant one, particularly big one. I've never heard of them before, but I was intrigued by the way that they talk about their marketing, and they said this: the millennial generation is like none we've ever seen before. The children of baby boomers, this generation has been raised with technology in their hands, higher education at their fingertips, and diversity all around them, defined as people born between 1980 and 2000. Any in the room? Yeah, okay. I'm one of them. This generation is more comfortable with interaction that happens online or via text than in person. On the whole, they are more liberal, less religious, less patriotic, and less likely to get married young, if at all. Because of their dissimilarity to the generations that came before, they require a new set of rules when it comes to grabbing their attention, gaining their loyalty, and getting them to buy. It kind of reveals itself at the end of that rather good description, doesn't it? That's what a marketing company is really all about. Millennials, it goes on to say, are as diverse as their iPhone cases. They want to be wooed, convinced, called out, and complimented for their individualized taste. The challenge is to figure out which among them you want to draw in and what about your product will make them want to make it their own. They're just telling you the truth, that if you want to reach this generation, this is how you should do it, because there's a lot of noise going on right now. If you want to reach the millennials, and there's money in their pockets, if you want to make a successful business, you've got to market to them specifically in specific ways. Interesting. And that's how they do it. This is the toolbox of the marketeers. This is how they get us. They form our minds. They shape us. We think we're free, but we're not really free. We've been constantly nudged into particular ways of thinking all the time. Seth Godin, have you heard of Seth Godin? He's another marketeer. He's a bit of a business guru-y type. He has a website, a blog. Do you remember blogs? A blog which he writes a short thing every single day. It's his discipline, his daily discipline. And a little while back in December 2016, he wrote this blog, "When Your Phone Uses You." This is what he wrote. "Your smartphone has two jobs. On the one hand, it was hired by you to accomplish certain tasks. In the scheme of things, it's a screaming bargain and a miracle. But most of the time, your phone works for corporations, assorted acquaintances, and large social networks. They've hired it to put you to work for them. You're not the customer, you're the product. Your attention and your anxiety is getting sold cheap." Think about it. When your phone grabs your attention, when it makes you feel inadequate, when it pushes you to catch up, to consume, and to fret, it's not working for you, is it? On demand doesn't mean you do things when the device demands, or does it? Incidentally, he's got a cool pair of glasses, hasn't he, and a great hairstyle. And I'm thinking next week, if you notice any changes, you'll know where I got it from. Tristan Harris, he's an ex-Google ethicist. Can you believe this? Which means he used to work as an ethicist for Google. Yes. The irony is not lost on him either, I think. So he was part of the young group of amazingly talented people who were trying to work out how to do these algorithms, ways of working out how to give us information about stuff. And he could see that, or they could see that this wasn't neutral, this was messing with people. What they put up made a massive difference to what we read, what we felt, what we thought. There was actually, there are rooms where they can, where they assess what is going on in the world, and if they put something further up, they change the algorithm, they can change the way that we think. So this is ethical. This is very ethical, isn't it? So they employed someone within the team who was one of them. But he realized, he's now an ex-Google ethicist, because he realized that the ethics weren't up to it and he couldn't remain within it. And he now does something else, and he calls it something like the company. It's a non-profit organization for humane technology. You can look him up online. But he's done various YouTubes, and people are relating to him. Now, he's not a person of faith. He's not a Christian. But what's interesting to me is that these young 30-year-olds are disturbed by something that is happening to them in their culture, regardless of what they think about Jesus or anything. But they are the ones who are saying something's got to change. And he calls it the attention economy. In other words, there is money to be put on your attention. Every little bit of attention that you give to something, well, people want to buy it. He calls it persuasive technologies. He used to work, before he went into Google, developing persuasive technologies. And the idea of persuasive technologies is that you can nudge people. You can nudge people to be kinder or more fit. So a persuasive technology is that Fitbit on your wrist. Just having it there makes you do things that you wouldn't normally do. Yeah? It's persuasive technology. Oh, there you go again. I must just check my phone. So here is a persuasive technology. So YouTube, you watch YouTube? Hands up, you watch YouTube? Put your hands up quicker than that. Honestly, you're lying to yourselves. You all watch YouTube in some way or other, I'm sure. But you notice the play again button or the autoplay button on the side. I didn't know this existed until yesterday, actually. Although my dad noticed what had changed, in that I used to watch YouTubes and then it would come to the end and then you'd have to make a decision about what to do next. And then now YouTube have put this autoplay thing as a standard default setting so that when it comes to the end, within 12 seconds or 6 seconds, another video comes up. Similar to the kinds of things that you're already looking at, so you might well be interested in. So I was watching Tristan Harris on the fight for our attention, and up came, why do you check your phone 150 times a day? So they guessed that I was interested and I might be interested in watching a bit more. That's called a persuasive technology. Adam Alter is another marketeer, and he's a professor of marketing, and again, he's interested in marketing, but he's interested in the ethics of marketing, and he's written a book called Irresistible, which I haven't read, but it says the rise of addictive technology and the business of keeping us hooked. And he does this really interesting talk where he speaks about the addictive nature of the technology that we're immersed in. And we're as baptized in this technology as any culture could possibly be. When you're baptized a child or an adult into another culture, it's nothing in comparison to the baptism of our children into this culture. This is a completely immersive culture all around us. And he's anxious about it, but he notices that there are no stopping cues. Does anyone know what a stopping cue is? A stopping cue is that bit at the end of something, or halfway through something, which gives you a chance to opt out and change direction. So a chapter in a book. Do you remember books? That's a book. See, the difference between a Kindle and it just keeps going, doesn't it? But a book had a chapter break, and at the end of a chapter, you might put it down and say, well, I know where I am, and put my bookmark in. Or a newspaper has an end, doesn't it? But a news feed is constant. It has no stopping cue. He did some research on how to change, to give people stopping cues, and this is a business in Denmark. And at 6 o'clock, the desks disappear. They go upwards. They rise at 6 o'clock. They just start moving at 6 o'clock in order to send everyone home. Because the desks literally rise up and the room becomes a yoga studio. It's a fantastic idea. It's a stopping cue. 6 o'clock, your work is done, the day is over. I'm going to introduce this over the road. I think this is fantastic. Have you heard about what they did, the Daimler holiday email policy? Have you heard about this? You know, because you're out of office emails, which we take our mobile phones away with us on holiday. Have you ever noticed that you check your out of office email account as you're on holiday? It's very hard to resist it, isn't it? Some people do it deliberately to check every day while they're on holiday in order to make it less stressful for when they return home. Although they carry the stress and they never leave. So Daimler thought that this wasn't a good way. So their policy is that they will delete any email that arrives when someone is out of the office on holiday. And this is what the email you get coming back. I'm on vacation. I cannot read your email. Your email is being deleted. Please contact Hans or Monica if it's really important, or resend the email after I'm back in the office. Danke schön. Now, that's the kind of company I want to work for. Now, can you see how that would change your behavior? If you sent an email and you think the person is still getting it in some way, whereas if you send an email and you know that it's been deleted, the responsibility is with you, the sender, to resend it if you think it's really worth sending. Can you imagine what it would be like to work for Daimler and be on holiday? You would actually feel like you are on holiday. Technology is ruling our lives, even ruling our holidays. Snapchat. Anyone on Snapchat? No, I didn't think so. This is what the others, the younger ones, use all the time. And they're on it all the time. Now, I didn't know about Snapchat, but Instagram likes are great. Do you know what an Instagram like is? Gosh, you're old. Ugh. Hearts on messages are fun. You know what a heart on a message is? Are you in the room? But the one metric by which many teens live and die is Snapstreak. Have you heard of Snapstreak? Anyone heard of Snapstreak? Some with kids have heard of Snapstreak. A Snapstreak is when you send direct snaps back and forth with a friend for several consecutive days. The longer you go without breaking the chain of communication, the longer your streak is. So every time they respond to you in a day, you get a little tick or a little streak. And so if you build that up over, you get 3 ticks over 3 days, 4 ticks over 4 days. So it builds up over time. Snapchat rewards longer streaks with special emojis, such as the 100 emoji for streaks lasting 100 days, or a mountain emoji for an extremely long streak. Many teens invest an inordinate amount of time keeping streaks alive. There's nothing more devastating than losing a streak you've put months of work into. Do you understand any of that? It's a little bit of addictive behavior. So now kids are going on holiday, giving their passwords to their friends so that they can keep their streaks going and the contacts going while the phone is not in use. They need to be in connection with each other. They take photos of nothing, send it to their friend just so that the snap streak is kept alive. It's a persuasive technology that is taking their attention away from breathing air and talking to people. Have you opened a packet of crisps? Surely someone say yes. At last, I found something you actually do. We all know, every family knows this, that as soon as you open the packet of crisps, it is empty. The time between opening and it being empty is very short, isn't it? And you never go, that's enough crisps, roll the packet up and put it away again. Never do that. It's impossible to do. There is something addictive about the crisp that as soon as you open it, possibility to you, you will keep going until it finishes. The technology world is like a packet of crisps that is always open to us. 72% of teens and 48% of parents feel the need to immediately respond to text, social networking messages, and other notifications. 72% of teenagers, but also 48% of parents. 57% of children under 16, this is under 16s, always have the phone beside their bed, and 40% of them, 44% of them, feel uncomfortable if they are ever without phone signal, which is the greatest crisis in our modern era. So this fight for our attention is constant. The CEO of Netflix recently said, "Our biggest competitors are Facebook, YouTube, and sleep." I mean, it would. This is what they're actually saying. They want our sleep. So Tristan says, "The attention economy incentivizes the design of technologies that grab our attention, and in so doing, it privileges our impulses over our intentions. Impulses over intentions. We've all got good intentions, but underneath those are impulses. Impulses are spiky, interesting, powerful drives within us. So what are your impulses? Impulses are fear, anger, pleasure, or approval. They're easy to hit, aren't they? And when you feel those, when those impulses are hit, which is what the social media world, what the technological world fills us with, we respond because we can't overcome our impulses, our good intentions for resting for a while, for being quiet, for being still, for thinking, for planning, for resting, for loving, for having time with someone else, are overcome by these other things. Nobody intends to look at the pornographic image on the side at 3 o'clock on an afternoon when they should be at work. They don't intend to do that, but they find themselves doing this thing. They don't intend to read another article about a president on the other side of the water, but they find themselves doing this thing. They don't intend to send out a message to other people in their group just so that they can have their approval rating go up a little bit and to be liked a little bit, but that's what we do. It's what we do. We've been trained to do this. The extractive attention economy, in other words, it takes something from us, is tearing apart our shared social fabric. The companies that created social media and mobile tech have benefited our lives enormously, but even with the best intentions, they are under intense pressure to compete for attention, creating invisible harms for our society. He lists six. Digital addiction. Digital slot machines occupy more and more space in our lives. Mental health. We constantly face a battle for our attention. Social comparison and bullying. Superficiality. A social system built on likes and shares prioritizes shallowness over depth. Breakdown of truth. It becomes harder than ever to separate fact from fiction. Polarization. Stronger ideological rifts make compromise and cooperation more difficult. Political manipulation. Creating discord through cyber warfare is far more cost-effective than military action. Wow. Wow. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1965 said, "How much of our modern life can be summarized in that arresting dictum of the poet Thoreau? Improved means to an unimproved end. We have allowed our civilization to outrun our culture. We have allowed our technology to outdistance our theology. And for this reason, we find ourselves caught up with many problems." So how do we follow Jesus? The call is to become a disciple. That's always the call for all of us, is to become, and Jesus invites us, "Come, be with me, walk with me, become like me, and then do the things that I did. Come, spend your attention on me, and I will lead you and give you life." James 3 is a famous passage about the tongue, about its power in our world, the small thing in our mouth that can change all sorts of things. I've changed it for mobile phone or smartphone. Have a read of this. "We all stumble in many ways. Anyone who is never at fault in what they use their phone for is perfect, able to keep their whole selves in check. When we put bits in the mouths of horses to make them obey us, we can turn the whole animal, or take ships, for example. Although they're so large and are driven by strong winds, they're steered by a very small rudder wherever the pilot wants to go. Likewise, the smartphone is small, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The smartphone also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. It's quite strong, actually, isn't it? That's quite strong. All kinds of animals, birds, reptiles, and sea creatures are being tamed and have been tamed by mankind, but no human being can tame the smartphone. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. I quite liked writing this. I quite enjoyed typing this out. With the smartphone, we praise the Lord and Father, and with it, we curse human beings. How true is that? Who has made us in God's in likeness. Out of the same device comes praise and cursing. My brothers and sisters, this should not be. Can both fresh water and salt water flow from the same spring? My brothers and sisters, can a fig tree bear olives or a grapevine bear figs? Neither can a salt spring produce fresh water. This is the list of restfulness and restlessness. And in the middle of the restlessness one is this word distraction. And it's the one I'm focusing in on today. Because it's the thing that I'm struggling with in my discipleship. And maybe you too. Because you're baptized into a culture that is demanding your attention. And although you have good intentions to pay attention to God, something else is winning the battle. One of the greatest challenges for our discipleship today is our ability to switch the phone off and to pay attention to God. I was on a spiritual retreat this week, or a study day of clergy. And one of the things I noticed about it was that all of us at the break times, the smallest of break times, would get our phones out. We become what we give our attention to, said Epictetus. We become what we give our attention to. Or put differently, Kenneth Blanchard said this, what we give our attention to grows. So the question is, what are we growing? What are we giving our attention to? Which is what Jesus did in the desert. Do you remember that Jesus was taken by the Spirit in order to learn something, to be tempted by the distractions of the enemy, and Jesus overcame the distractions and was then able to go into ministry and mission. We need to do the same. And he said, when you fast. I'm going to invite Esther to come to the front. Esther has an idea that could be helpful for us. It's a very simple idea, and it's this ancient, well, it's older than Jesus. Esther, tell us about your idea.
Taking it off you.
Yeah, that's good. Tell us about your idea.
Yeah, so just an idea, very old idea, to fast and pray for a week together. That's it.
So how would we do that? What would that look like?
So 2 weeks' time, just the beginning of Lent, and it's just so much easier to do something together. And we would just fast, which would mean, you know, we're very attached to our phones. But actually, there's nothing like stopping eating to realize how much we need God. I mean, who finds prayer difficult?
Yeah.
It's amazing. When you stop eating, you go, I'm not eating, therefore I'm praying.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so your invitation to us is that we might join you in a fast. A food fast. We might also do some other fasts as well, I guess. And that we might do that together. And the way of doing it together is that we might meet with others. So what time do we meet with others?
So what the idea is, we have a week set aside. And those of you who are out of town, we'll meet together 6:30 in the morning.
Okay, good.
And then if you're around closer than 9:15 in the morning for 30-minute prayer, to hear from God. And to intercede, to pray, to bring all our needs to God. So those two things, to hear God's word for us and to pray for others.
That's enough. That's brilliant. Thank you so much. To hear from God. To hear from God. So my quote of the day is, pay attention to what you pay attention to. At least give yourself a chance to notice what it is that is pulling your attention in various ways. I had a Sabbath on Friday, which is my Sabbath day, and I put my phone away the night before, and I didn't get it out the next morning, and I said to Tori that my aim of the day was to give her my intent, my attention for all day. She hadn't ever heard me say that before. And that, she said, what should we do? I said, well, all I want to do is just give you my attention. And we found ourselves talking and listening to each other and had a really good time with each other. And it was broken as soon as my phone went back on again. Pay attention to what you pay attention to. My other book that I'm just going to mention in brief is this thing called The Benedict Option. It's a challenging read. Benedict, Saint Benedict was a monk, or at least he wasn't to start with, but he became one, and he drew people into a rule of life, and he said, in order to rescue ourselves from the culture that we've been baptized into, we need to baptize ourselves into a different kind of culture. He set up some rules about how to live. And that book explores ways for being different in our world. Because the church that looks and talks and sounds just like the world has no reason to exist, says the guy who wrote it. And maybe we're as addicted as the world out there. Christians often talk about reaching the culture without realizing that having no distinct Christian culture of their own, they have been co-opted by the secular culture they wish to evangelize. And Paul, one of Jesus' early followers, said the fruit of the Spirit is self-control. And so Rod says this, developing the cognitive control that leads to a more contemplative Christian life is the key to living as free men and women in a post-Christian America. The man who desires, whose desires are under the control of his reason is free. The man who does whatever occurs to him because a little number has pinged on his phone is a slave. Father God, would you help us? Would you set us free? Would you help us to pay attention to you? Help us to take control of what we eat, of these technologies that we have in our pockets, of how we use our holidays and our times of rest, so that we could be with you and then be equipped to be your people in the way that you want us to be your people. Forgive us for our lack of attention. Help us to follow you. Amen.